I am your host, Jason Miles, and this is Revolution Podcast. Happy Monday to the majority of you. For the select few that are patrons, happy Sunday. Are you guys going to watch the playoffs today? It's Sunday for you patrons. Again, if you didn't know, if you are a patron, not only do you get access to the bonus champagne room, which we now call it, you also get the audio only a day early. But that being said, this is the audio only. The Monday show is going to be a audio only of our Thursday, kind of our version of a week in review. We try not to make it oh so newsy that if you go back a couple weeks, it's just kind of based in that moment. In this one, Pascal does tackle the interesting question of the potential U.S. involvement in the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. Cuba discusses something that we're probably going to be talking about quite often on this show. I shouldn't say probably, that we do talk about quite often. And that is living in late-stage capitalism. How does it affect us living in these later stages of capitalism? And what is techno-feudalism? Has capitalism now morphed into something even more odious? Has it turned into a new feudalism? And of course, I wrap things up with a short 3-minute monologue about this political moment that we're in as we are coming up on midterm elections, which it looks like the Democratic Party is literally trying to lose. It does feel like, and it has for some time, that we are watching political theater, politics as a reality show. Is there more of a lust for enigmatic leaders than there is for a creation of a real movement anchored in the working class? Have we sacrificed the working class to the far right? Is your vision of a working class person still Archie Bunker? Some of the questions we ask, and if you are a patron, the bonus champagne room. We talk about Russia and the Ukraine, and we talk about the new docuseries from W. Kamau Bell, where he discusses the sadness he feels because of Bill Cosby being a sexual predator. Patreon.com/Bitter Lake Presents. Wherever you're listening, there's links in the description. If you have the means you'd like to help the show grow or just get access to the content, do it. That music means I've talked too long. I am out. everyone, and welcome to another Thursday News Roundup edition of This is Revolution Podcast. I am your host, Jason Miles, and if you are new to the show, new to the channel, please hit like, please hit subscribe. Do not forget to hit that bell so you are notified whenever we go live, as we are constantly adding new shows to the channel. We will be adding a reaction show to the Monday night video essays. So if you haven't noticed, every Monday we've been running video essays, if not from people here on the channel, myself, Pascal, Kuba, Jean. We also run Doug Lane's Critical Cuts from time to time. But there is a new video essay in the works. I'll say what it's on. It's on the Grifter piece that I wrote some time ago. So we'll be doing a video essay on that. That should be dropping Monday if all goes well. And then we'll be doing a reaction show to get your guys' take on what you saw and give us your opinions, like we did last time on the Punk Politics show. So that's another thing that we're going to be adding. So don't forget to hit the bell so you are notified whenever we go live. And we have a lot to fit in today. And if you are a follower of my co-host, my homie, my dog, then you know he was on a bit of a 80-tweet rampage. But in a good mood, we had a talk before the show. He vented a little bit. So I'm excited for tonight. Please welcome, coming all the way live from South Florida, he is the man of the Mau Mau Hour. He is the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason. Mrs. Miles.
What up, man? I'm excited for tonight. We were actually getting juiced. We were playing my... That is my pre-show music, actually, before I go on stage, what we were playing before we went on air.
Jamiroquai?
That and Fishbone, that Everyday Sunshine. Sounds like gospel music. That shit gets me fired up. Are you pumped now?
I feel good. I'm in a good mood. I talked to my mom today. She watched the video that I did with Wos Di Lombre. She loved it.
Ah, she liked it.
She said, yeah, it was good. You talk too fast, but it's okay.
She called you the Black Ben Shapiro?
I don't know about all that.
And let's bring in our other member of the TIR crew. I also talked with this gentleman before show today, because what he is going to discuss definitely dovetails into what I'm going to close with. Please welcome everyone's favorite middle manager of the Death Star, Deep State Kuba.
Hello, everyone. The it's not all it's cracked up to be working on the Death Star, but watching the Book of Boba Fett, that organization has some problems.
Well,
he could use some middle management, is what I'm saying.
I've been trying to. So after the show, I try to decompress from what we do, because, well, I'll be completely honest. After the show, what I can do now that I have better Wi-Fi, what I was doing when we were in Oakland was I would dump the audio and I'd do the intro for the audio only podcast. And I actually set all that up. And then when I'm done with that, I take a break for a minute and I try to watch something that has nothing to do with anything we talk about. And I've been trying to watch the Book of Boba Fett, and it isn't capturing my attention like The Mandalorian did. And one of the best.
It is not good. The Book of Boba Fett.
I like Ming Na Wen. I like the Jango Fett / Boba Fett. But together, the show.
No. I'd rather be watching the Book of Boba T, if you know what I mean, right? At least that's got tapioca balls. But I gotta say, like, the henchmen he picked up recently are 100% rich LA dude's idea of what like bad street teenagers would be like.
Oh, okay. So don't tell me anything more. I left the last one I left off. He like walked up to him and they have like mechanical shit limbs. And I was like, what? And I was like, let me stop watching this for 1 second because it's not very good. And then I usually fall down a rabbit hole of Dan Larson videos. Dan Larson, also friend of show, does have a new video up on the Mr. T cartoon. So I definitely will be watching Dan Larson's new show on the Mr. T cartoon. And we will be bringing Dan Larson back on, if not in February, because you know the TRI rule for Black History Month, fit as many white people on as you can.
Traumatizing.
So we did last year.
That was by accident.
It was, but it worked out because all the black people are busy doing other bigger, blacker shows, which is the email response they give us. Sorry, we're doing bigger, blacker shows. Mark Lamont Hill called. They don't say that. But that's what they really think. Well, let's get into what we're going to discuss today. And Pascal, you wanted to discuss the goings on in Haiti. And there was a recent article in The Intercept by Ryan Grimm where he does talk about the fact that there was possible U.S. involvement in the assassination of Jovenel Moise. As The Intercept reported in July, the Colombian mercenaries who carried out the hit were hired by a Florida-based firm. At least seven of them had received training by the U.S. military. So, Pascal, what is going on in Haiti?
Well, just to recap, for those who do not remember, basically over the summer in June, July, the Haitian president, Jovenel Moise, was assassinated by an assortment of international actors from South America, largely Colombia, in his residence, and his body was allegedly mutilated rather badly. The United States and the West have been supposedly aiding in facilitating investigations at who the murderers were or the planners were. There have been various suspects who've been arrested, some of them affiliated with international military from other parts of the country. Some of them are members of the Haitian elite. My initial speculation in terms of what was going on with the assassination was due to the fact that Jovenel Moise was trying to freeze out the traditional Syrian and Lebanese Haitian oligarchy, that coterie of financial actors basically have been fed up with him trying to cut them out of their market share of exclusive control over the economic development in the country. And pretty much with the green light of the United States, had him assassinated. As I stated, the United States, no one is going to assassinate a Haitian president without at least getting the wink and the nod of the United States and its intelligence agencies or the State Department. But what has been surfaced in this recent report by Ryan Grimm in The Intercept is that the United States might have had its own interests in having Moise assassinated, in that he was basically becoming a domestic embarrassment for American foreign policy in terms of he was causing a massive immigration wave when Biden was trying to, you know, cease having problems at the border. The gang troubles in terms of the political instability that his tenure in terms of extending his presidency for a year was really angering people on the island where his popularity was low. And many, many people in the Haitian diaspora who had supported Biden were complaining about the strong arm tactics of the Moise administration. And basically what Ryan Grimm demonstrates is not only were some of the mercenaries involved in the United States recipients of U.S. military training, but in March of 2021, 4 months before the Jovenel Moise assassination, at a House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing, there was a testimony by the former U.S. ambassador to Haiti, a woman named Pamela White, in which, in that testimony, this is 4 months before Jovenel Moïse's assassination, Pamela White, basically explaining all the chaos that's going on the island, says, and I quote, "We may need to set President Moïse aside and go with a prime minister option." Now, the only way you want to set him aside is to have him resign. What's interesting is that in that same testimony, she admits he probably won't resign. So you're saying in the testimony but that he won't resign, but you're also saying that he has to be set aside. So if you're admitting that he won't resign, what exactly is the methodology that you're intimating is going to be used to have him set aside? And second of all, you say we're going to have to go with the prime minister option. What is fascinating about that is that there was a conflict in terms of who the prime minister of Haiti would be after Moïse's assassination. At first, it was a man named Claude Joseph, and basically the core group, which are the international embassies of foreign countries, France, the United States, Spain, Canada, that basically control with the U.S. State Department what's going on in Haiti, via tweet said, Claude Joseph has to go, and we're going to choose Ariel Henry, who has been implicated in the assassination as well. But what is interesting as well is that in the same testimony, Pamela White says, we're going to have to choose a prime minister that we basically can work with. And the prime minister who was chosen, who was one that was chosen via tweet by the core group that works in concert with the State Department. All that to say, back to has to be set aside a statement, who exactly and how are you setting this man aside after he's been assassinated by people who had U.S. military training? And one of the actual apprehended assailants, a Middle Eastern Haitian oligarch elite named Rudolf Jarre, who was picked up in Turkey, by the way, of Middle Eastern origin, states that his goal, and he's arrested, he might serve life, his goal was not to kill the president, but to intimidate him and threaten him. And this is what Rudolf Jarre says upon investigation. The only reason that he agreed to do it is that he was instructed that the U.S. government was totally in alignment with the muscling of Jovenel Moïse. This is a man who's been interrogated by the U.S. government. So as I stated earlier, my initial position was that the Haitian oligarchs initiated the desire to take out Moïse because of his intentions of cutting them out of their market share and appeal to international actors. I'm kind of reversing my position now. I believe that the U.S. state, allegedly, and its intelligence apparatus, put the trigger out on Moïse, got the oligarchs to cooperate because they both had mutual interests, and the U.S. is the main pusher of the button that gets Jovenel Moïse whacked. And my assessment is based on not only Rudolf Jarre's testimony, but particularly the testimony of Pamela White at that House Foreign Affairs Committee meeting 4 months before the assassination. So this is all happening under the Biden administration. What does this all mean? I'm ready to open it for discussion.
Well, Cooper looks like he's ready to just fucking put a gauntlet down of insider truth.
I think that it's a matter of sound imperial management that you, when it comes to the leaders of the countries in your periphery, in your backyard, you engineer personnel that are compliant, that understand what it is that the regional hegemon needs and requires, that don't color outside the lines, And if necessary, especially in a country like Haiti, where there's a domestic American perception that this is a chaotic place, that bad things happen in Haiti, you can use assassination as a plausible tool, because you know, it could have been anybody, right? That's all you need to do. If you're assassinating somebody in a place which where there is a perception that those things are uncommon, they don't happen, that political succession is orderly, it becomes much more difficult to do. But I also think that after the withdrawal from Afghanistan, there's a surplus of covert ops, special ops type muscle that is looking for a place to go. And you saw this after the American withdrawal from Vietnam as well. There were different operators, operatives, not just American, but also from allied countries, that no longer had a mission. And they needed to be retasked and put back on the payroll as quickly as possible, or there's the risk that they talk or they get entrepreneurial and they get involved in the type of underworld shenanigans that you don't countenance, that might be running counter to your overall regional interests. So I think that it's plausible that there was some element of the American security apparatus that helped coordinate. I think that you're right that the major beneficiaries of the Moise assassination were the domestic oligarchs, but he wasn't managing Haiti effectively from the perspective of U.S. interests either. And with the level of kind of neglect that has settled into a number of different foreign policy areas after the Biden election, not to say that Trump was better, but there's a lot of gray space, unmanaged gray space within the American security apparatus when you have a weak president that's distracted by domestic problems. If you just go, you don't have to be that senior to operate on your own volition, as long as what you deliver is relatively untraceable and ultimately benefits your political bosses. And if that's the case, then no one will ask too many questions and you'll find some top cover to sever any connections between the assassins, between people who can be traced, and U.S. agencies. So it's unlikely that we'll have conclusive evidence, because if it's true, then there'll be active efforts to suppress any of that information from coming out. We still have classified documents from the Kennedy assassination. So it's one of those situations where the most that we can say is that this is certainly a plausible theory. It fits into how we know the United States sometimes operates in the Caribbean and in Latin America. And it works with the great power interests of the United States as well. It's something that one might see in Azerbaijan, for instance, with Russia playing the role of the kingmaker and kingbreaker. So it is not so much a uniquely American pathology so much as regional power play by a hegemon. That said, one bigger problem is what happens after this. And one thing that the U.S. security apparatus is terrible at is having plans in place for the succession of power and for the day after one of their operations. They either need a strong local partner like Pinochet that can establish order, or they end up in Afghanistan, Iraq situations where they've eliminated a linchpin that is keeping things together and without anything to fill the vacuum. And I'd be curious to hear, Pascal, what you think will happen next.
Oh, I think the United States already has a potential orchestrated next president in line. I think that they're going to expedite. They have various plans being orchestrated by Haitian elites in the United States who are part of the diaspora. We have this thing called the Montana Accord. We have this thing called the Louisiana Accord that was based on elites of the Haitian diaspora acting like they're acting on the behest of the Haitian people in Haiti, trying to come up with paths and ways forward to move ahead. One of them is called the Montana Accord. Another one is called the Louisiana Accord. Another one is called the Penn Accord, which is, and there's another one that's being promoted by the international community. And the bottom line is that I don't see any of them really being interested with the actual domestic sovereignty of the Haitian people. But what's going to need to happen is that the question that happens is that who's going to control the gang activity on the island? Because the only people that have the military muscle and the power to disturb any kind of sham election or any type of election are the gangs. And if no one is able to secure the ability of the gangs to not disturb whatever election comes about, then they're not going to be able to have an election that people are going to believe. So the question becomes, who is the puppet administration that they can put a power that is going to be respected enough by the gangs that they are not going to subterfuge the election? So the United States is in a sticky situation, because if it's too transparently a sham election, the gangs are going to shred it up under the auspices of being some kind of Robin Hood project to protect the integrity of the Haitian
people. Kim Ives still pitching that barbecue as kind of the new leader of a, I don't want to say a Marxist movement, but like a revolution?
I heard apparently he's still pushing that tripe, that nonsense, yeah.
And how do you feel about that? Do you want to tell people who barbecue?
I think it's nothing but white fetishization of the Mau Mau of the Negroes.
Oh, tell me how you really feel. Kuba, we lost your sound.
That was just incompetence. Do you have any insight on how the gangs operate in
the Haiti? Gangs initially were being financed internally by the government and by the oligarchy to seek reprisals against each other.
Like the Tonton Macoute?
What is that?
Like the Tonton Macoute?
Not like so much with the Macoute, because the Macoute were officially controlled by the state under Duvalier. But they were basically, the gangs are basically mercenaries for hire. Allegedly, the weapons were bought by the state and the ammunition were provided by the oligarchs. So they were basically used by those two competing factions to take reprisals against each other whenever it was convenient. But now what it seems is that the government is not in control at all anymore. And it seems like there might be factions of the oligarchs who are still willing to pay the gangs to protect their private property, and also take money from the gangs when they receive money payoffs for people they kidnap. Because the oligarchs aren't ashamed to get involved in that dirty business either if they can profit from it. They sell. The guy Rudolf Jobs is a known drug dealer. They sell drugs too. It's not like they're clean businessmen.
But like just nice drugs like mushrooms and marijuana, right?
No, cocaine. Cocaine, man!
Do they start talking like Cubans?
I don't know about that.
Well, Scarface is very popular. And they that start talking like Al Pacino, not like Cubans.
Worst Cuban accent ever.
So it's really a sticky situation, because I don't see a clean path forward with the gang factor as the X factor as well. And there's none of the candidates I see that they have are popular enough with the Haitian masses or the peasantry to really have the kind of cult of personality that would make it impolite for the gangs to take reprisals if they were elected.
Would what's stopping the gangs from just taking power in their own right?
I don't think that they have the political wherewithal to be a governing force. And I don't think they want to be that, because that means they'd have to be responsible as opposed to just being thugs and making money.
I'm very curious about this, because I think that this is a situation where after a state collapses, you've got a situation where coercive power, control is up for grabs, and without a regular military to step in or an extensive internal security apparatus, the best organized forces are going to be the gangs. They're the ones who have violence and muscle and people who take orders and are willing to sort of kill and risk their lives. The alternative is like another peacekeeping force.
I don't think the U.S. wants to do that again.
Yeah, it just seems to be bad for everyone. You get very little done, and you end up with a tarnished reputation and a black eye. After the cholera outbreak caused by the UN presence after the last earthquake, it's hard to see how they'd have any local legitimacy either.
Totally agree. So it's a screwed situation.
Well, moving on, because we have a lot to discuss here on This Is Revolution. I want to bring up Cuba's topic, which is techno-feudalism or neo-feudalism or living in the late stages of capitalism.
What comes next? I think that this concept of techno-feudalism became very popular as a result of some pieces and interviews that Yanis Varoufakis, the Syriza finance minister, former Syriza finance minister of Greece, gave to a number of different outlets, where he's a trained economist. He's on the left, but he has a very solid grounding in the models and concepts of conventional neoliberal economics as well. So he is making an observation about where we are in capitalist development. This is how capitalism ends, not with a revolutionary bang, but with an evolutionary whimper, just as it displaced feudalism gradually, surreptitiously, until one day the bulk of human relations were market-based and feudalism was swept away. So capitalism today is being toppled by a new economic mode, techno-feudalism. And his observation here is based on the fact that financial markets have unmoored from real economic indicators. So you could have a 30% compression of the UK economy while the UK financial markets continue going up, up and up. And when you observe the behavior of financial markets internationally, they're crazy. They are no longer observing the rules that neoliberal economics, that conventional economics expects for them. Similarly, governments are behaving much more generously, or they're much less cautious about different forms of stimulus and monetary expansion than they were in the past. For him, this is a real smoking gun, that the old rules of capitalism no longer apply. And then based on that, he's looking for what the new model, what the new sources of growth, what the new patterns are. And the techno part comes from the observation that platforms like Amazon, Facebook, Google are sources, monopoly sources, monopoly institutions, where you can extract value just from having this enclosed network. having these users that you basically sell to other interested parties, and that financial profits come from quantitative easing or from central banks pushing more and more money into the system, which can then be appropriated by peak interests. So that is his take on techno-feudalism. And he sees essentially a move away from a production-based economic system to one where the relationship, the collusive relationship between central banks and these platform oligarchs has entrenched them, creating a self-reinforcing power and wealth dominance at the top through these institutions. When I heard this concept, I think that he's onto something. Certainly the fact that financial markets are operating the way they do with irrational increases and the break of relationships between bonds and stocks, these very well established correlations that were supposed to be the kind of fundamental laws of economics, that the old capitalist model is over and there's something else happening. I think that the feudalism part is actually underdeveloped. He undersells it, because along with the breakup of the old productionist style of capitalism, you have such concentrations of wealth at the top. There's 2,500 billionaires approximately in the world that represent a massive component, an unprecedented component.
And that's up from how many before, though? We've seen that.
So it's when you're looking at historical comparisons of the concentration of wealth, it's very difficult to make a kind of one-on-one comparison, because you also have to factor in inflation. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much the number of billionaires. In fact, if the number of billionaires were 10 times as great or 100 times as great, it would be less concerning. But the fact that this small number of people control such a large proportion of global wealth, not only that, but through the international system of tax shelters, and this got revealed in the Panama Papers, Thomas Piketty wrote about how much wealth is concealed, just vanishes in the Cayman Islands, vanishes offshore in Jersey, Guernsey, in the state of Delaware. And the emergence of what are called family offices for billionaires and their kin. A family office is essentially a private bank that concentrates on making investments for the sake of a single family. And right now, family offices internationally have more capital under management than the hedge fund industry.
Jesus.
So, yes. And unlike the hedge fund industry, which in theory has open funds where teachers union can buy in, a family office is just there for the family, is just there for a single group of ultra wealthy.
The Waltons, for example.
The Waltons, the Gateses, the you could pick any number of famous families. And the most frightening aspect of this actually is the ones that you can't name, right? The people who have succeeded so well in amassing their wealth, that the Pritzkers, that's a good example, but the ones that we don't name are the ones that not only have all of this power, but the invisibility and the anonymity that makes them particularly difficult.
Because we only have the same old names, right? We only have Jeff Bezos, and maybe you yell out Bill Gates, but generally it's just the same old names that we relate to major companies that we know.
And yeah. The some billionaires can't help themselves and step into the public light either through political activism or vanity. Bezos, Branson, the Koch brothers, Bill Gates. Mm-hmm. But for all of those, there's an order of magnitude more that value their anonymity and privacy to a sufficient extent that you just never hear about them. Sometimes the family office, especially if it's there's a shortage of personality within the actual owners, sometimes the family office can take over, right? And then you have managers basically telling the family what's going to happen. But no matter what, this is the case of private familial centers of power. And that's where the feudalism comes in. You have a replay of the privatization of force and of power that came with the breakdown of the Roman Empire and the emergence of all of these individual centers of power, where you have a lordly relationship with either your customers or your clients, or especially your employees. The changes in American governance, especially the gutting of unions, the elimination of restrictions on what corporations can dictate to their employees, has reinforced that trend towards, frankly, like manorial type of power on the part of owners. And I think that, you know, if we can't get the political implications out of the piece that Varoufakis wrote, there's a comic book called Lazarus that plays them out in to their logical conclusion with global crisis leading to the collapse of states and their replacement by not corporations, but families. Families who own corporations and who can mobilize the type of wealth and personnel that allows you to replace the coercive power of a state. We have oligarchies in Haiti, and I think that in some ways, if the Haitian oligarchy coalesces around one or two families, this would be how it would play out. A state that's already been hollowed out and can't provide services to its public, that doesn't fulfill its governance obligations, also loses its coercive monopoly. And the only people who have the domestic power to step in are personal, are families linked by personal connections. And nation states require some sense of national solidarity, some collective bonds in order to operate. And if you sever those bonds, which is what we're seeing happening, the atomization of individuals and the winnowing out, the hollowing out of government agencies, then there's got to be some other basis for cooperation that can be effective in reimposing order. And historically, one possibility is the family and the household around that family. In Lazarus,
I wouldn't say we have a super chat. Surely got a super chat. We should not ignore it.
Of course. The movement of these massive flows of capital is balkanizing humanity. And how can we be so sure we're living in the late stages of capitalism? If the next stage is techno-feudalism, that sounds even harsher. What will be the left's response? That's an excellent question. And if we are moving towards, it comes down to a coordination problem. If you want to govern a space, you need to have a way to organize people, to deploy force when necessary, and labor when necessary in order to achieve your policy objectives. The left, as an organized force in that way, doesn't exist in at a level that it could push back against things like powerful oligarch conglomerate or even things like organized crime. And unless the left can achieve that level of cohesion and discipline, unless it can generate for itself Soviets or cadres or other types of organizations, a political party where people actually follow a policy line, where, you know, right now the Democrats complain that voters are insufficiently disciplined, that they're not voting like we need them to, but they're establishment Democrats lose sight of the fact that discipline cuts both ways. You're also the leadership and elected officials are not governing the way they're supposed to. Without that discipline, you don't have an organization. You have a collection of individuals that like the same color, but can be picked out, flipped, twisted, corrupted by people who actually do have some discipline. And if the left isn't there, maybe it'll be somebody else that reconstructs the world. And unfortunately, there's a shortage of potential institutions that aren't horrific, that aren't terrifying, that could fill that gap.
You don't think the techno, what we call them, the techno capitalists, the hippie capitalists in Silicon Valley are going to be ones that want to change the world? I mean, that's why I think we kind of went a little back and forth a few weeks ago about the potential for some sort of single payer healthcare in California that was coming out of Silicon Valley. That wasn't actually shocking to me, because I do think that as much as you disagree, I definitely think these are the people that really believe that they are going to change the world. And I think part of their missions, outside of making a gajillion dollars, is world changing. I think they get a real huge kick out of that.
I think they're libertarians.
Yes.
Yeah, they don't mind state help. They don't mind fucking subsidies.
Well, and also, if you think about the oligarchs, yeah, sure, they have the capability, they have the resources, they have the power. But then you're going to, at best, create medieval Venice, meaning that you're going to have an oligarchy of tech executives running essentially a feudal city state or region inside the US. And that may be better than the alternative. That may be better than what happens in Florida after America, but it's not going to be a leftist or a progressive vision. It's just going to be a different oligarchy that sits on top. That's one reason why I bring up the billionaires and the concentration of wealth. The number of people who can muster this kind of force under this kind of influence, this kind of power, in late capitalism, without something that changes the basis of wealth, that changes the basis of power, something like the criminalization of tax havens. So, you know, we're just, if your money's in the Caymans, it doesn't exist anymore. Sorry. Yeah. Right. Unless you do something like that, which would cut the legs out from under these concentrations of wealth, then they've become so large that you could just buy entire regions, buy entire countries. Especially if you not only have that liquid wealth, but you also have a conglomerate or a consortium of tech businesses, some security businesses, some other firms that give you the manpower and the technology to supplement your financial strength.
I mean, what do you think, Pascal?
I mean, I think it's capitalism, man. people with money, power, and greed. I mean, I understand you had a feudalism. What is feudalism with capitalism where the masses don't own assets? It's basically what it is.
Well, the significant difference is the collapse of the nation state, right, as a governing institution.
But if the nation state only survives to fulfill the interests of capital and the lords of capital, okay, we're going to get rid of an intermediary?
Well, there is a difference between with that intermediary, because it's not there's a couple of things the nation state does that aren't just executing the preferences.
But this is the thing, right? The oligarchical families mm-hmm. are going to have to get people with guns yes. to be loyal to them that aren't in their families.
Yes.
The only way they're going to do that is to pay them.
What happens yes. when money has no power? That was, what is his name? Douglas Rushkoff. He won't say who he was brought in to speak for, but he said it was some really powerful people. And he gave his usual spiel. He's the guy that wrote Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. And he says the main thing they wanted to know was, okay, that's all great, but what do we do when the world, everything collapses and money has no power and our guards turn on us? Like, we need to know, how do we survive that?
And he was kind of shocked. And there's a few answers there. One is, make sure you hoard not just money, but commodities that are essential. Right? Like, get all the water in your control, pull a Mad Max. Another alternative is to develop an alternative vision for the future. When everything's falling apart, that might be enough to cement, especially a team of young people, right? Or even better yet, child soldiers, to loyalty on your side, right? Create a cult of personality. Use social media, use surveillance technology to make life miserable for everybody and a little less miserable for the people who are willing to do violence and be loyal to you. There's ways of constructing those violent cadres. And after a certain point, it begins to reinforce itself. One of the ideas in Lazarus was that society was divided into three classes. You belong to a family, and there were 12 or 13 that ran the entire world, divided up geographically along very representative lines. You know, it wasn't just white people. The Middle East, for instance, was run by the Myers-Kasimi family. You know, so both Israelis and Arabs together at last. Yeah, it's the pinnacle of woke capitalism. But below the families, there were the serfs, who were bound and served the families. And below them, 90% of the population was waste. That's actually how they're described within the system. And they're subject to arbitrary power and entitled to no resources. If that's the world, if those are your alternatives, you know, serve and become a serf, where at least you know where your next meal is coming from, or take your chances under a fully broken system. In the United States.
Let me tell you why I have a problem with this stuff. All right. The people who have wealth are going to want more wealth, which means that they're going to want to make shit to make more wealth. They're going to need people to have money to buy their shit. If no one has money and everyone's waste, and the serfs are broke, they're not going to be able to make more money.
Oh, at a certain point, that doesn't matter, right? Like, the reason that you care about money is because at the highest levels, it translates into power. You can buy violence. You can, be Jeffrey Epstein. You can make things happen in the world. A large enough fortune gives you agency on a historical scale. And most people don't even have agency in their personal lives. And if you break out of the control of the state, which is the only institution that is capable of holding back peak oligarchs, if you can break out of that prison, either by destroying the state or by subsuming it, then your the money has your picture on it. You don't need to compete with other capitalists to see who's the richest, because all control is now yours.
All right, listen, this is basically an Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged wet dream. And I'm sorry, I think that what's going to happen is you're going to have people pick up weapons and just kill these crackers or Negroes or whatever they are on site when shit gets too rough.
And the so that's a question, right? Like, so my sister and I were talking about Bitcoin, and Bitcoin to me seems like a type of zombie insurance, where you're betting on the breakdown of the international economic system to the point where dollars are worthless, but somehow the internet is still working, so you can use Bitcoin instead, which strikes me as crazy. But the idea that you have a breakdown in order that is severe enough to sweep states out of the way. And given the way that the track record of especially democratic Western states, especially the United States, in this pandemic, it's clear that there's much less solidity there than a lot of people assume.
Well, let me tell you.
So you sweep it away, but there's enough technology to still give oligarchs the advantage. How many drones, how many automated death robots do you need to protect you from an angry mob?
Well, do you know what is interesting about the paradigm that you put forth, Kuba, quite frankly?
Mm-hmm.
Not trying to be sectarian, but mm-hmm. it does kind of demonstrate that anarchists are kind of on weak ground on their argument that this biggest thing we have to fear is the state. And I've kind of made that argument. It's like, why don't anarchists worry about the state and they don't really like talk about the private corporations? The state exists to protect private capital.
No. I mean, the state exists for a number of different reasons. The state exists mostly to protect against other states.
Right, but each state in itself protects the interests of its respective power elite.
But that power elite is constituted differently in different states. So
I agree with that.
And one of the great innovations, one of the sources of the East Asian economic miracle, was the relative autonomy of the state bureaucracy in countries like Japan, South Korea, Singapore, and that's true of some Western countries as well. That you have a professionalized state bureaucracy that sees its mission primarily to itself, that we are the custodians of the country, we keep foreign enemies out, and we keep domestic peace. And we're willing to trim the oligarchs if that's necessary for the sake of domestic peace. And you see that in China. The Chinese state will shoot billionaires.
Mm-hmm. See it in Russia. Putin will take reprisals against oligarchs.
Yes, this is exactly. And basically, if members of the capitalist elite are able to be executed by the state, then the state is more than just their enforcer.
Go ahead, finish.
And so that's what is at risk when the state goes under.
That's not what America is.
Of course. I mean, but America is exceptional in the sense that it has a lot of unique features that don't necessarily replicate in other countries. I would say that it's particularly bad in a lot of ways.
And I would argue for that particular reason, because there's no check on private capital.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But that doesn't mean the state can't be a check on public private capital, because it has been elsewhere.
Moving on. You guys all see the clock on the screen.
Kuba went over time. It wasn't my fault.
It was.
I'm sorry. I'll be better next time.
Your fault. It literally was your fault.
Just don't put it on my quarterly evaluation, please.
I will be brief, as this does somewhat dovetail into what Kuba was talking about. As most of the discourse today has centered around the Biden administration and its inability to challenge the GOP and its goal to roll back civil rights and voter suppression laws, as being unable to push through any economic reform for the majority of Americans suffering during a deadly pandemic, I can't stop to think about how all of this plays out in a sort of a scene reality show. Politics as theater. This isn't a new phenomenon, and it didn't start with Trump either. Much of what I see is inside baseball talk about political strategy, ineffectiveness of progressives, and of course, the impotence of the Biden administration to deliver for the people that put him in office. But maybe we're wrong. And the administration is delivering for the real people that put it in office. We haven't seen a rollback on Trump's tax cuts, Biden's foreign policy, while it promised on the campaign trail to lead the nation back to the good and respectable global police. It was apparently before Trump took office. It has not. The Biden administration rejoined the Paris Climate Accord and canceled the Keystone XL pipeline. The administration did remove the Clean Energy Performance Program out of their Build Back Better bill at the behest of West Virginia's Joe Manchin. During the COP26 climate conference, the Biden administration announced the selling of 80 million acres of Gulf Coast for oil and gas drilling leases. With all this said in the midst of a midterm election year, what is the cry from the majority of talking heads and political insiders? Primary Biden. Sure, but with who? And what do people expect will happen? Every major political event in this country, from the abolition of slavery to civil rights to the New Deal, has a long, hard-fought battle rooted in the working class. Nostalgic revisions of FDR to LBJ have many looking for an enigmatic figure that leads us out of the capitalist nightmare. We recently did an interview with journalist, scholar, educator, and most importantly, activist Chris Hedges for The Real News yesterday. And in a new article that Hedges wrote in Counterpunch, he writes, "The question," Karl Popper reminded us, "is not how we get good people to rule. Most of those attached to power, figures such as Joe Biden, are at best mediocre, and many, such as Dick Cheney, Donald Trump, or Mike Pompeo, are venal. The question is rather, how do we organize institutions to prevent incompetent or bad leaders from inflicting too much damage? How do we pit power against power?" We've mentioned on this podcast several times, and we'll discuss in the Champagne Room, but primaries and rhetorically calling to push candidates left without a movement rooted in real working class struggle might be the definition of inertia. So if you're a patron, the link is up. We'll see you soon. If not, sign up. Patreon.com/Bitter Lake Presents and be a part of this discussion. Also, we're going to talk about what's going on with Russia and the Ukraine, as well as W. Kamau Bell's new docuseries on how we will view Bill Cosby. Is that good?
All right.
Well, thank you guys for watching. I hope we see many of you in the Champagne Room. The link is already up. Real quick, I'll put it up if you guys don't know what it is to become a patron. Bam. And we are out.